We have only four verses, but they're really quite, what shall we say, packed. Why don't we read them? I put them on the board there. It's 6:1-4, the sons of the gods and the giants. And, well, we're just a small group. Why don't you just read one verse, and then Oscar read the second verse. Would you read the third verse? And we'll split the fourth verse up into two sections. Maybe Bob and Harold, if you... One read the first, and the other one read the second of the two sentences in verse 4. So why don't we do it that way? I think that'll give us the structure. That's what I'm interested in first.
And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them,
that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose.
And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with men, for that he also is flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years.
The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came to the daughters of men.
And they bare children to them, and they became mighty men, which were of old men of renown.
All right. I think that if you had read just a little farther there, Bob, when the sons of God came to the daughters of men, comma, and they bore children to them. Do you see that? But that's, as we'll see, a little paraphrase.
I'm just going to leave Harold a little bit more.
Okay.
Closer to the half mark of the verse.
Translation is a little different, I think.
Yeah, they are.
I really, the King James, there were giants in the earth in those days.
So yeah,
that's very
well,
poetic.
Yes, it is. Well, no, I'll tell you, the King James, they were verbal inspirationists, and so if there was one Hebrew word, they put down one English word. And you can usually tell it. They even put italics when there wasn't a word there. So it's a very precise sort of translation in a sense. I still like it very much. Well, I'd like to ask this question. Assuming that this is another crime and punishment story the way we've had in the Garden story and in Cain and Abel story, and we'll have in the drunkenness of Noah and also later on in the Tower of Babel, what's the crime here? And then what's the punishment? That's maybe two questions. What do you think?
What's the crime?
The way they chose their wives?
I think it was that the gals were beautiful. That's the crime. Not really. That has to be discovered. And, you mean the way they chose them?
I guess I don't see any crime at all.
You don't?
Well, I guess in theory would be because if there were two races, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, there's certainly.
Like, I mean, when the Greeks would, a Greek god would come down and have a child.
Yes, I think that's really what's behind it. That you've got Nephilim, giants, and this is the Greek word gigos. If you want a comparable idea, look at the Pergamum altar to Zeus, where you've got the Titans. Fighting with, well, against Zeus, the Olympian gods, and the Titans, the demigods there. And they're pictured very interestingly. That's in the east zone of Germany there, and if you ever see it, you never forget it. The giants are kind of big muscle men, demigods. They have snaky limbs and so forth, and they're about to, let's see, Pelion on Asa in order to get up to Olympus and storm heaven. And what you're saying about the Zeus coming down to, say, Semele and then begetting the muscle man Heracles or something like that. I think that's really what's behind the giants. It's not purely, like we'd say, a giant that's really tall. It's more like in the Nibelungen or any of these other stories that it's real combination. So there is something here. I don't think there's anything wrong in the first part. You know, the crime isn't this that the men began to multiply on the face of the earth. I think that's a rather natural thing. It's not as if there's overpopulation or something like that. and the daughters were born to them. There's nothing wrong with that, nor with the daughters being fair. That's something that's there. But I think that, well, there are two things here. First of all, they took to wives such of them as they chose. Anyone have an Old Testament parallel? I think that's where you have to kind of get at this, see what's going on here. Someone used that very word, took to wife, well, what didn't belong to them. Crossed some sort of a barrier. Well, it may not occur to you, but if you have a precise parallel in David taking Bathsheba. And not only smitten with her beauty, but taking her and then beginning the child and getting rid of the husband, in that whole story in 1 Samuel 11. Or you have the same thing, same word too, when the Pharaoh takes the beautiful woman, Abram's wife, in chapter 12 of Genesis. And we did have this word here when the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was pleasant and good to the eyes, could make you wise, and she took it. Same word.
You mean this word is different, this took is different than other?
No, I think it's taking this the same way. In each case, someone is stepping over some boundary. In the case, you know, when you take somebody else's wife, and or in the case of Genesis 3, the command of God.
I mean, is this, and this Hebrew word for took in all those instances different? Does it have a different connotation?
No, it's the same connotation as this word here.
You know, in our own marriage vows, or in the marriage service, we use, do you take this woman to be your...
Yeah, well, no, actually, it's a word like rape, you see that? I guess that's what Mary is getting at.
Yeah.
In other words, she's taking what is forbidden. In the case of the marriage ceremony, it isn't quite so, you know, it's not that. It's not illegitimate. Everybody can stand up and say... Yeah. But am I getting at what your question is, Mary?
Yeah, I think
I think this idea is they took them. You see, a lot of people are smitten with beauty and have the desire to get it, but somehow the restraints of society, if they could have the power, in your case, they do have the power, you see. I think that's why you've got the sons of God. They can do this, you see that. And then they go in unto them, and then they raise up these giants. I think that's the whole point here. They're more than just, well, human, you see that. I think that it's a very short story. I think that its content is what is offensive, really, to... I don't think that the story itself, despite its brevity, is unclear. And I think, well, Harold, you had said you were wondering about whether that's a crime.
I guess I didn't see that this... Mm-hmm. They took them wives. I didn't understand that there was an implied transgression.
Yeah, I think there is. I think that's quite clear. See, these stories, you must realize, you know, are quite well known in that time. So Oscar, I think, is on the right track, that this is one of those stories that you know that, you see that. And here, of course, it's some sort of a no-no, some sort of a boundary is being transgressed, you see that.
Well, in the fifth verse there, it talks about the wickedness of men. So
yeah.
That's why the assumption is that...
Well, yes, although I wouldn't really let the fifth verse, the beginning of the Dillard story, call the shots in this story. I think this story really comes to an end here at verse 4. As all these stories, crime and punishment at the end, they have a kind of an etiological, if you want to use that big word, explanation of why things are the way they are. And we had that at the end of the garden story. We also had it at the end of the murderer story, the Cain and Abel story. And here you have the same thing, too, that there's a reminiscence in ancient Israel, that's really all that's left of it, that there were these Nephilim. And they were the mighty men that were of old, men of renown. And that's kind of the way it is. But I think we haven't clarified one thing in the structure, and that is... what is, if that's the crime, you know, this trying to be a superhuman, and as happened in our family when there were some overstepping of the boundaries, it takes two to make it. And the daughters of men are also involved here. Here in humanity is represented by the female part, and it's rather natural here. But so that's the crime. But now I think the punishment that we haven't talked about, I think that maybe, I think it's kind of clear though. Verse 3, the Lord said, my spirit will not abide in man forever. He has proved to be nothing but flesh. That's the idea. Flesh is over against spirit here. Not in the Pauline apocalyptic sense, flesh and spirit or something like that. Or Jesus in the garden, flesh is weak, but the spirit is strong. The flesh is strong, but the spirit is weak. But here it's simply the spirit that he had given to man will not always abide in man, but his days will be only 120 years. And here again, you have to take that if they have these astronomical days, you know, these years, then 120 is really a multiple twice 60, and it's not very much, you see. And it's still more than what the Bible ordinarily gives for the span of a man, some 90, 70 or 80 years. But it's still some sort of a bringing down the time, lifespan of man to what is more like human rather than what is kind of supernaturally long and lengthy, the way you have, what is it, Methuselah, 969 years. And so somehow there is some sort of a punishment, some sort of a curb. Now, what is surprising perhaps in the story, and that's why it's not quite as transparent a story as it might be, and open there to a lot of other possibilities of interpretation, is that when God brings the judgment here, his judgment as such is not described. In the Greek myths, the original myths, and comparable ones in the ancient Near East, you would have Prometheus, one of the Titans, leading the revolt of the new generation of demigods against heaven, you see. That is not described. Nor is the actual intervention of God described. I would take verse 3 there, is that the Lord is kind of in a soliloquy saying to himself, this is what's going to happen. The description of actually how that worked out is not mentioned, except in maybe what you might call the epilogue there in verse 4. All that's left now for the people in the time when this is now put into writing and so forth, is that they remembered that there were mighty men of old, men of renown, and they had remembrances of that. I don't know if any of you know that in Numbers 13, that when they wanted to conquer, they sent the spies up to Palestine, and they said, they're the sons of Anak, they're the giants up there, you see that? And they're also then, as I said, they're referenced to the sons of the gods in Canaanite literature all the way through. Now, this may be offensive, and I think it is offensive to any monotheists. You see, you could translate the sons, B'nai Ha Elohim, you know, some of the translation is what? The sons of God, isn't it? And then you could take that translation, and even there, take it in two ways. You could say the sons of God means humans, believers. That's the very traditional idea. But why in the world the males should always be believers and the females be the seducers and unbelievers and so forth, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's, I think, quite a different way of translating. We mentioned that in the genealogies last time. Why should that one genealogy be super, the genealogy of Adam be the, and Cain, through Cain be the one of the unbelievers, and the one of Seth be the believers? I think that's a kind of a blind alley. A second interpretation of that, the sons of, notice, not the gods, the way I'm taking it, but the sons of God. You can translate that too. It can be B'nai Elohim, or in this case it's B'nai Ha Elohim, the sons of the gods. I prefer to take it just that way, and refer therefore not to angels, but to refer to the well-known gods, if you want to say in the Greek sense, Olympian gods, or the gods on in Mount Zaphon, in Canaan, that come. Now, the big question here, that if you're going to take it that way, drink your whiskey straight, you might say, then that is very offensive, you see. And why would monotheists, that's my next question, why would monotheists, and the Hebrews are monotheists, and they're not interested at all in fomenting a sort of mythological views or having a polytheism in telling these stories. How did this ever get in the Bible? Doesn't it mess up the place and stink a little? And don't you have to fumigate it a little? what in the world? What's this doing here? Why should an ancient myth rear its head in the midst of Holy Scriptures? In other words, this is a real problem or something like that. Anyone have any comments about it? Now, this is, of course, assuming that it is that offensive and not just a certain type of human or angels. It'd be bad enough with the angels. But then if you say it's the angels, and the angels did it, then why in the world are humans the one who get punished and zapped for it? You see that?
Well, I mean, one way, I suppose, to reconcile the apparent polytheistic tone of monotheism would be to say that humans held false gods before them and sort of credited certain kinds of powers and so on to a devotion to false gods, to try to read it in a way that would relate it to the danger of cultural achievements.
Yes, I think you're on the right track there. In other words, the same sort of going beyond bounds that we had in cultural achievements, or that we had in the garden story, or in the Cain and Abel story, is here. The only thing is that here you've got not an individual who's doing it, but it's what? Mankind. Mankind, it starts that way. They began to multiply on the face of the earth, and that's a dangerous possibility, see? Mm-hmm. And then also, beauty is a dangerous possibility. It doesn't have to be, but if it's found and somebody is smitten by it, and if someone has power to transgress or step over the boundary, then the only way you can possibly tell a story about that excrescence is, even if you're in a polytheistic, you're yourself in a monotheistic, culture, but you know that people in your own culture or other people may have other conceptions, and they did have other conceptions, you can therefore refer to it. I suppose it's something like Wagner in using the old Nordic myths for the Ring of the Nibelungen. There he referred to the giants and the dwarfs and all of that, and the only thing they can do up there in Seattle when they have the ring is to get the modern psychologists, and then they will have stories of what the Fafner and the dragon and the giants and all these people mean in modern psychological terms, because that's the way people understand it. But I think if you try at least to understand Wagner, the twilight of the gods, and the beginning of a new humanity, then you know what Wagner meant, what he intended with his drama. Or take maybe a better example, C.S. Lewis will take elements of science fiction and will, in Perelander or something like that, and of space age, and use them to tell his story about in Perelander, the seduction of the innocent, isn't it mean, is it Mars or Venus, the Adam and the Eve that are there, and he tells that story in a rather, he's a kind of a modern myth maker, and a Christian one. I think that's what they're doing. So I don't think that this person is fomenting a belief in polytheistic gods. But he is trying to express this fact that one of the possibilities of men blowing it, and he's mentioned many of them so far in his stories, is this possibility of man being more than human, superhuman.
Okay. I'm confused now. Mm-hmm. We started out saying that in essence the error was in the taking rather than in the...
The first part would be the taking, doing what ordinary people can't do, overstepping it, and because they're gods they can do it, you see that. taking these women. But then the second thing is what?
Well, that's not a hassle for man.
No. But,
I mean, if we're going to translate it in this polytheistic mode, mm-hmm. that's God's Yahweh's possible wrath toward these other gods that may exist.
Yeah, and that occurs elsewhere in the Bible where he gets after these other gods.
But that doesn't say
anything. You are gods, but you will die as men.
But that doesn't say anything about the punishment.
No, but wait a second. You can't really just only take that one aspect,
okay.
of them taking it.
What did I?
But you also have the fact that the daughters of man. I mean, that's the daughters of men. They went in unto them. This is, a certain amount of cooperation there, whether it's a violence or not. And that then the result is, I guess that's where I should put the accent. I didn't mean to put the only accent only on the taking, you see that.
Mm-hmm.
The result is these monstrous superhuman beings. So the crime, I think, is not wanting to be and remain merely human. And I think that's why the punishment is this reduction of their vitality, their long lifespan, to a much more limited and abbreviated one. That's the way I would take it, at least.
Is there a kind of hubris here, then? I mean, this business being smitten with beauty. If the daughters of men are beautiful, and by this we mean not simply females,
mm-hmm.
but mankind now is beautiful, that is, assesses himself as beautiful in many ways, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
and then allows himself to be transgressed by false gods. Is that on the track? Or?
No, I think that's true. That it's finally a communal sin of all mankind. It's not the individual as we have in these other stories. See that? And there's only one comparable story in Genesis 1:11. That would be the Tower of Babel, where all of mankind wants to get all of itself together, pull itself together, in order to kind of crash the heavens. And in Hebrews, make a name for itself and so mm-hmm. forth, guarantee of its existence. And they're using technology, making new bricks and building cities, and it can do that. Now that's not explained here as such. All it is here is the doing it on a level of their vital human existence as living, powerful people. And I suppose the only thing you can have is these ancient muscle men, the titans that you see on these statues of the ancient giants. I think that's precisely what they were thinking of. The Nephilim were something like that. And I suppose the only reason they did it is the same way that C.S. Lewis would have his spaceship going up from someplace in England to beat out that American spaceship with American unbelievers who were trying to sow in Perelandra the seeds of unbelief there. And he simply does that. It's not because C.S. Lewis is anything like Van Denegan and the Chariots of the Gods. He's quite a different sort of guy. But he does use that in order to get his point across. And that is a bit offensive. Let's ask one more question that might help us here. When I look to a bookstore today, I'm kind of amazed at what sort of things are in bookstores, especially these new comic books. They sometimes take, they're kind of a lot of myth makers. And I can't give you the names because I don't know that literature at all. It's a sort of comic book literature, but it's more than that. It's gotten slick, and sometimes it's kind of pornographic, I think. Do you know what I mean when you go to these bookstores? I don't read that sort of stuff. It looks a little bit trashy to me, but maybe I ought to look at it a little more. They are telling stories of the early world. They're telling of superhuman adventures. Well, you turn on your TV on Saturday morning and look at the children's programs on the Sentinels. And you've got Hercules and Mercury. And then you've got a Zeus figure. Or really, it's a god figure. It's almost a Christian figure. Star Wars and all this sort of stuff. And this is sort of superhuman. I don't think it has to be our California muscle man, that are breaking all of the rules and so forth. Those guys seem to be quite harmless. But I think what you have coming out of a lot of this literature is expecting, in some way, mankind, not just the individual person, to be superhuman. How can we bring this within our realm of experience? I guess that's what I'm trying to say here. Well, when you talked about the Ethiopian church yesterday and the Coptic church, and you said that when someone asked, what's the difference between that and our sort of Western religion? And then you said, well, their emphasis is to be more godlike. And that is, of course...
Well, theopoiesis, I think, is that this emphasis in the Eastern tradition is the stronger in that area, isn't it?
Oh, yes, I definitely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You get, I was in Egypt and way down in, next to, at Karnak, and I found out that everyone on that side of the river where the ancient temples were Christian Copts, and the other side of the river, they're Arabs and Muslims. The sort of religion that I found there by just scratching the surface was just that sort of, it has big whiffs of Gnosticism. I think it's genuine Christianity, and they do finally take the incarnation seriously. But because they are all mystics like John's gospel, they tend to run off into that sort of man becomes God, you see that. And I would submit this, now this gets to be a little more problematical, but in the case of Jesus of Nazareth himself, what our world has done and made of him is Superman instead of man. And I think in the miracles and Christmas and many other aspects. What he himself refused to be, what the evangelists refused to make of him, the Orthodox evangelists, the ones that got in the canon, that man has made of him, Superman, and expects that everyone else would follow that way. And I think it's very dangerous. One of my friends, a historian of religion at PLU, Paul Ingram, says that some of the sectarian churches that he sees, and he goes through the churches, through the towns, I don't think I'd go quite that far, but he just says they're temples of Gnosticism. And he just feels that, he comes from Southern California, and I guess he knows them and has had his nose full of them, but he just feels that these people are not taking the humanity of Jesus seriously. And I guess that's where I think I would clue in on this sort of thing. In other words, if you're not going to see Jesus within the parameters also of these stories as the universal parameters, as one who enters genuine human history, as a genealogy like these genealogies of parentage, and is really right in the midst of history, but see him as sort of the emanation from the fullness of the deity that finally comes down here for a while and then ascends and leaves and is far away, and that we are finally to get the knowledge of how to get there, then I think that we are kind of doing the same sort of thing. Well, I've spoken enough here, perhaps too much. Any comments about this story or about its possible meaning for today? It's a very offensive sort of thing.
Now, is it offensive in an American society, in an American Christian society? That sort of myth kind of making, that kind of myth making is so common in the Hindu way of thinking of things that I guess the main thing that a Christian has to watch out for is that they don't simply pile one myth on the other and add their own myths, which I guess finally is where Gnosticism, the path along which Gnosticism goes the wrong way. But I don't see that this story would be all that offensive in a Hindu-oriented Indian society.
Mm-hmm. Nor in the perhaps much of the modern American society, you see that, where you see that on TV every Saturday morning, maybe during the week too. I don't follow all that stuff, but
Christian society.
Pardon?
I want to say Hindu-oriented Christian.
Oh, Christian people. Society, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, Hindus would lap it up. That's just another one
of
their things. And first-generation Christians will simply blow their stacks. But you will never find a person who is more anti-Hindu than the first-generation Christian. But when he's gotten a little farther away from what he has left and begins to see the tremendous cultural advantages that have come out of his Hindu culture, then he turns around in his second and third generation and he says, you know, there are ways of speaking that really are effective, and I think he would then be able to hook into this much more unemotionally.
I see. All right. I think, too, these guys weren't really... if I said offensive, I guess I have to qualify that. I don't think that the people who told this had a bad conscience about telling this. It was the one way they could get their point across, you see. And I think living in that culture with that as a very real background, they could easily tell of that, and everybody understood what they were talking about.
Well, that's coming out of a somewhat separatistic culture as well.
Yeah, they were no longer, what shall we say, threatened by references to such things.
They had been called into it's coming out of a cultural setting where they've been called into a setting of a unit they're constantly facing, or they have been constantly facing, the existence of other gods in other societal settings.
Yeah, that's what he was saying.
Yeah.
I think that's right. Yeah, and therefore...
There's no offensiveness there. I think the offensiveness that is likely to come in terms of our contemporary setting is to suggest that, a term or phrase like sons of God or sons of gods...
The gods, yeah.
Would be found in Scripture and not refer to believers.
Yeah.
That's just... Mm-hmm. Something that's totally outside of the parameters of a lot of people's thinking.
Yes, and I think that perhaps this the suggestion I'm giving you is a minority suggestion as far as counting heads and numbers. I think among serious Bible students, it is more and more gaining credibility and acceptance. The one in between. See, first of all, it was just always say. Humans, believers, that's what's meant by the sons of God. And then secondly, people said, well, and they had a lot of information on that too, it means angels, get the idea? But then to go the full way and simply say, no, it really means these gods that begat the demigods, then people are shy away from that. You see that? They say, how can there be a myth in Scripture? And I guess my response would be that Scripture is referring to an ancient myth, a real stinky one, as far as real monotheism is concerned.
That's the way you try to handle an adult Sunday school class.
Yeah, mm-hmm, that's right. Whereas it's not trying to have that myth function the way that myth would have functioned. How would it have functioned in Baal religion or in the ancient Near East? Well, it's part of the cult story that accompanies the sacred marriages in which you've got the deities renewing the earth with fertility. And I suppose the Israelites, they pretty well knew, you take the whole story of Sodom and Gomorrah and all the Canaanite fertility, Lot and his wicked daughters, getting them drunk and then this incest, everyone knew in Israel, that can't be done among Israelites, you see that. All the homosexuality, all the perversions, they didn't look at it so much as, say, a modern American would as a merely perverse sex, but as irreligious. That's not the way to get a seed. You have to wait, in the story of Lot and his wicked daughters, you have to wait till God's promise comes, even if you have to wait until you're 100 years old, that's fulfilled. And it doesn't come even from Ishmael. You have to wait till God fulfills it with Sarah, and that's the way to get the seed. And so many times, and there are a number of such stories in the Old Testament, such a thing should not be done in Israel. So the Israelites, I guess, were no longer, I think you're right, threatened by a reference to this myth. They were pretty well on solid ground. I suppose today, the reason maybe why it's offensive, that's a good question, is because people are a little threatened by this sort of thing, you see.
I hear you saying by this myth, why using myth?
They don't really, some people say, well, if you're going to go into that world, then you're going to have to go into all kinds of stuff that's flying around in America, and chariots of the gods and so forth, and they're very uptight about it, and perhaps rightly so.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know why we should be so uptight about those things, let me say it that way. I wouldn't be offended by this.
Are you suggesting that the Israelites to whom this myth was told, in a sense, demythologized it? I mean, to say that they weren't offended by the myth, or somehow...
That's right. The myth no longer functions as it did in the other... And so it's... Reverend Childs calls such references throughout the Old Testament broken myths. Do you see that?
Now, if I understand that quite correctly, what I don't understand then is how do you take the final business of there were giants in the earth in those days demythologize that? Because I can't see how that's the giants in the earth are anything other than some kind of supernatural beings.
Yes, in primeval times there were these supernatural beings, see? And they were the result of this monstrous union between the gods, sons of the gods, and humans, daughters of men. But God has judged that and brought mankind down to its normal limits. That vitality that they had was not permanent, it died out. And therefore now, all they have now in historical times, the times in which this writer says at the end here is, those are the mighty men of old, the men of renown, the people that you hear about in all of the myths and stories. And the people, think of Heracles or something like that. They would think of such people. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do.
But maybe...
I'm not sure that I see how the sort of use of the myth is consistent throughout, and it seems a different weight is being put on different parts. And that may be simply the heuristic use which the myth was.
Yeah. Well, it depends upon, if you want to call it myth, maybe you could do that, put it in parentheses, or you can call it, as Reverend Childs does, a broken myth, or elements of a myth.
Yeah.
All I want to say is, though, it's referring, however, not to some watered-down story, but it's referring to a genuine sort of myth that they really told in polytheistic culture. Now here, if it's more... I got into a little trouble once, it wasn't the only time I got into trouble, by writing an article on the biblical view of the sexual polarity of male and female. It was printed in CTM, Concordia Theological Monthly, in 1970 in April. And when I came to that part, I very well realized that people would misunderstand this, even though I explained it in such detail. So wherever the word myth came, I put it in parentheses. And when it was brought up, and in certain charges that were leveled against me by a pastor in northern Illinois by the name of Otten, then he simply would read this, and he never took all the distinctions I made, not even the distinctions that you even put something in quote, you should really read that, the so-called myth, do you see that? As if I were teaching polytheism. I wasn't doing that at all. I was doing pretty well what I'm doing here. Mm-hmm. Not precisely that way, but pretty well the same way. So it depends upon what you think. To that pastor, it would have been very, very offensive to even suggest that this was a reference to a genuine myth, you see. Mm-hmm. I think he wouldn't like C.S. Lewis either, really. Maybe he would, I don't know.
Well, he even suggests this is all prime historians.
Yes, that's right. For him, everything has to be history.
Totally offensive.
Yeah, that's right. But I think when it says, in those days, you see that, there were giants, there were Nephilim on the earth, I think that's quite a a statement, and that means what? In primeval times. And then you'd have to make that great distinction, which I think must make, between primeval times and our times.
Yeah. You probably are familiar with Lovelock's novel Giants in the Earth.
I was thinking of that this morning when I was looking that over.
Reading a little of the his own background, one time said that in that section of northwest Norway where he came from, although it was Christianized, everybody nevertheless believed that there were these sort of primeval nature spirits that were lurking sort of in the frozen north somehow, and that there was a kind of cosmic and I suppose quasi-Gnostic battle going on in the mind of the North Norwegian pietists, and the reason why you were Christians was in order to protect yourself from these giants of the earth and so on.
So those nasty Swedes that have been mating over there with the gods that are coming to get it.
No, I think that is really behind it, and I think that's really what's behind a lot of these movements today. And
so that's what I was going to suggest. I mean, there, in pietist movements, at any rate, there is very often the other side, sort of the dark, pagan, polytheistic, evil, threatening.
Precisely, and they make of the devil a counter god,
and
not a creature that is going in the opposite direction, and whom we, by unbelief, give a real, genuine existence. But they make him almost existentially another god.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think this is why this threatens them.
Yeah.
I think that's all very... I would like to really study the comic books. I think there's a whole theology of comic books. Does anyone know what I was referring to? I only saw it in a few bookstores, and they're these slick sort of things that you have to pay $7 for, and I say to myself, look, for that trash, just to find out what I want, and maybe I should be able to get some other hold on it. But I would really like to study
I've
this.
I've had a couple of students who have studied comic books fairly seriously. I mean, it began with a kind of fascination for these things that they just always had, but then began to study theology and literary criticism and psychology and so on, and began to do this sort of thing. You know, their papers aren't very sophisticated, but on the other hand, they've convinced me that there is a real myth-making operation going on, and there are some very fundamental primeval stories being retold.
Yeah, and there's some of them reputable publishing houses, which I don't think would just publish this stuff if they didn't, the editors at least didn't think there was something here. It tends to be pornographic, and I suppose they can get a certain amount of circulation there. All the people appear naked and all this and that, and you've got all these people. I suppose, who is this man writing, and I know very little of it, Tolkien, is doing the same sort of thing today, or at least for us.
Gunnar about that. Reading
that
stuff.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
Well, I think it's about time as far as our official time. This is always late.
He's the guy that writes all this myth book sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one way to get at it, isn't it?
Kind of fascinating, although I can't move through them very fast.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to learn a whole new way of a book ever. It's like reading candy.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we'll begin then tomorrow. We'll have 2 sessions on the deluge and the flood. So begin that tomorrow.